time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Good morning and welcome to Delmarva Public Radio and Delmarva Today. I am Gretchen Hansen sitting in this morning for Don Rush. While the first vote on H.R. 2, or the Farm Bill of 2018, failed to pass on May 18th, it is widely anticipated there will be a second vote held during the roll call on June 22nd. Today, we're going to examine the Farm Bill's impact on supplemental nutrition assistance programs and how that was formerly known as food stamps benefits our community, as well as the enduring social stigmatism of the program. SNAP benefits cost $70.9 million a fiscal year and supplied roughly 44.2 million Americans, or 14% of the population. I will be speaking today with Michelle Medeo, who is a public benefits attorney with the Homeless Persons Representation Project, and Tina Maria Lopez, who is an administrator of training for Union County Division of Social Services in Union County, New Jersey. Union County Social Services is charged with taking applications and determining eligibility for the SNAP program, as well as training about eligibility requirements. And in the studio today with me is Kristen Homan, a chef and writer who owns Nevaeh Industries. Kristen was a benefits recipient after her divorce in 2009 and wrote a book about being a single mom with three kids at home and her experiences cooking while on SNAP called Money in the Kitchen. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gretchen.
So, Kristen, I'd like to start with you, and I'd like to ask you what your most difficult experience was in starting the SNAP program and how that impacted you.
Probably the most difficult thing was realizing that I did need help, swallowing my pride, my ego, and going to the office and applying. I was so proud and couldn't believe I had found myself in that situation where I was so desperate. And finally got over my ego and applied and was able to move on. From there.
Tell me a little bit about your background, Kristen. You were a college graduate, you had a good career, and then you found yourself with three teenagers at home needing supplemental nutrition. And what was your first reaction to that experience?
Well, it was recession inspired is how I ended up on the programs. And, you know, I had gone from making a salary 45 plus to half that.
Right.
And so... having that nutrition program really saved me so much stress and heartache because, you know, not being able to feed your children in the way they were accustomed to, even if you weren't accustomed to that, just not being able to feed your children is very stressful.
Certainly. Michelle, I'd like to talk to you about H.R. 2 and how it makes deep cuts in SNAP, which provides food assistance to 40 million Americans. Could you explain the consequences should that bill pass on June 22nd to the program?
Sure. So it would cut a lot of the funding that goes to provide SNAP. So there would be a significantly less amount of funding available. It also would strengthen and make the work activity requirement much harsher. So this is a requirement that you would have to work in order to receive SNAP, and it would cut off benefits from people who are not able to maintain employment. We do have a work requirement already in existence, but the bill would make it much, much more restrictive and affect a lot more people.
Tina, I'd like to ask you how that work requirement could positively or negatively impact some of your clients that you work with.
Well, the work requirement currently calls for about a 30-hour-a-week work program. And many times our clients, as you said, are low-income individuals or people who find themselves in a low-income situation. And as such, they have to travel to certain places, and that can become a hardship, even just to go for the initial evaluation to find out where you are to go for a work program. Also, travel becomes a serious limitation within people within certain areas, and that can also negatively affect how much money they have for other things that SNAP benefits do not cover.
Can you explain how that transportation affects food stamps, because I in the SNAP program, because some of the research that I did during preparing for the show showed a direct correlation between lack of transportation and lack of income. Is that something that you're familiar with?
So when you look at the cost of public transportation or even the availability of public transportation, for example, let's say you have a person who's maybe limited income, and they're looking at something like maybe $700 or $800 a month in limited income. They have to be able to pay their rent. They have to be able to buy other such products, such as toilet paper and paper towels, that things, you know, that don't necessarily are not covered, you know, deodorant and other things, by the SNAP program benefit. Now you're adding to them an extensive cost of having to be able to travel, having to prepare a lunch in some situations for themselves in order to, you know, be substantiated during this work activity that they're required to go to. It's just an extra added expense on people whose income is so limited as it is.
Michelle, could you talk about the eligibility to receive SNAP benefits? There seems to be a lot of misperceptions about what those numbers are and where they stand. One of the things that I experienced as I was preparing for this discussion today was there was a lot of misperception about who receives SNAP. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So in Maryland, you know, SNAP operates as an entitlement program where if you reside in Maryland and fall below a certain income level, you are entitled to the benefit. So eligibility depends on income and some expenses. So so for example, in Maryland, minimum wage is, you know, $9.25 an hour. And in order to afford a one-bedroom rental at fair market rent, which is approximately, depending on where you live, but the average is $1,219 a month, this means that at minimum wage, you would have to work 101 hours per week at minimum in order to afford rent. And so that's why we see a lot of people who are working who still need to receive food stamps in order to survive. And so the benefit depends on your income level, but they also look at what your expenses are in terms of rent, for example, and utilities, to see how much money you actually have available to purchase food at the end of the day.
So what I'm hearing is that there's a tremendous disparity between a minimum wage and the amount that you would have to work to actually survive. So there's that inequality gap there.
Absolutely, yeah. The minimum wage is not a living wage. And so, you know, we see people who have two full-time jobs, you know, barely getting by. And, you know, I think most food stamp recipients do actually have some employment earnings coming into the household. It's just not enough to be able to purchase the most minimum amount of food to survive.
Kristen, I see you nodding your head vigorously in support of that. I know during...
I'm having flashbacks to those days. Yeah.
So tell me what you were doing while you were receiving benefits. Tell me how much you worked.
Well, I was in the construction industry and everything bottomed out.
Right.
Went into the service industry, server, bartender. So, wait, what was your question? Sorry.
How much you were working during the time you received benefits?
Oh, well, I found a job. Well, I was bartending and serving. Mm-hmm. And then a friend of mine that has a hustle all the time, he was like, oh, hey, you know, I know a guy needs help. Can you go to his boatyard and help him shrink wrap boats? So I got paid under the table. Shh, don't tell anybody. But but it was temporary. You don't shrink wrap boats year round.
Right.
You do it at the end of the season. You know, before it's cold, it's dirty, it's cold. I was working with all men. Mm-hmm. It was weird.
So you were working several jobs is what I'm hearing.
Oh, I sold shoes, shrink wrap boats. I was a plumber's assistant for...
You were doing anything you could.
Anything.
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 And you had three kids at home, all teenagers, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. Nonstop eaters.
Right. Yes. And two of them teenage boys, so
yeah.
We know how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
And in your book, you only use whole ingredients where you talk about how to cook on food stamps. Would it have been easier for you to have that USDA approved, like Blue Apron box, like President Trump is proposing, or would that limit you and not be practical in your experience?
Mm-hmm. I think that Blue Apron box is the same as whatever a food pantry might hand out to you.
Right.
You know, here's some pasta, here's some beans. I think having the economic freedom to pick and choose what I want to buy and what I want to cook for my family with a strong background. Luckily, I have that and the interest in it where I was able to cook in a nutritional way using what I have and stretching that dollar.
And you're still now teaching that too as well.
Absolutely.
So you're trying to teach those different skill sets in the kitchen.
Yeah, I volunteer at different places trying to educate others.
Tina, there's been a move to legislate further what can and what cannot be bought with SNAP benefits. How is this practical, and how is this going to increase your administrative burden in what you do?
The problem becomes with certain things that it leans towards big agriculture and big pharma's preference. So you can buy a can of SpaghettiOs on food stamps, but you cannot buy a prepared rotisserie chicken on food stamps because that's considered a prepared food. So that's a hardship on a lot of people who are on the SNAP program. Many people who are on SNAP are disabled in one way or the other and sometimes have trouble preparing food. And being able to purchase those products would be a huge asset to those that are receiving it. Now, as far as administrative costs, it becomes very difficult because you have to have certain computer programs that allow certain food programs. That's why you see certain food stores will say EBT cards accepted and certain food stores won't, because you have to have something that says a paper product is not accepted, your toilet paper isn't, your deodorant isn't, but that can of SpaghettiOs is, or that green pepper is. So that becomes expensive for the retailers as well and limits people's ability to use their EBT cards in certain areas.
So one of the things I noticed in reviewing the HR2 bill is that the bureaucratic costs increased in the bill, and yet the amount of assistance that was going to the SNAP program actually decreased. So in the end, the program cost more money, but most of it was going to bureaucracy. Is that what you're saying would happen here?
More than likely, that's what you're looking at. If you look at certain elements of the bill, and I don't want to go into the nitty-gritty of it, but there is a subsection in 4015 that talks about ineligibility for the program if you do not participate in this work program requirement that they're trying to implement. And what they're saying is that you would be kicked off the program for 12 months and have 12 months of ineligibility if you do not participate in the program, or if you can come back on if you gain employment enough to be able to be considered under what they consider a work exemption from the work program. Now, the problem with that is that people have lives and situations and things happen, and you wake up and a kid throws up and you wake up and something's wrong. And sometimes those work programs are not always the easiest to get to. Like we talked about previously, transportation is unavailable. So in looking at the administrative cost of that, you have to think about the fact that you need a social worker to track that specific person going to the work program, a social worker to limit the person, and a social worker to make sure that they are not back on assistance if that, in fact, does become law within 12 months of them not participating in the work program.
So, Michelle, this branches into something that you cover because most of your clients are predominantly housing insecure. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So how closely linked is that housing insecurity with food scarcity, and how could this additional bureaucratic burden impact people who are housing insecure in addition to needing to receive nutritional assistance?
This would have a huge impact on our clients who are either experiencing homelessness or very much at risk to being on the streets or in shelters. Many people experiencing housing insecurity, like was said earlier, lack access to reliable transportation or a stable mailing address, telephone, clothing, other supports which are critical to finding and keeping a job. Even if you have all of those supports in place, my office is based out of Baltimore City. We have a lack of low-skilled job opportunities in the city. The unemployment rate is high. And so even if you have everything in place to be able to work, there might not be a job opportunity available for you in that moment. And you still need to eat. You should not have to go hungry because you are unable to find a job or you can't find a job for a particular reason. I represent people who have been unlawfully denied or terminated from food stamps. And one very common thing that we see a lot is the agency that administers the food stamp program will send a letter to someone's mailbox, whatever's on file, and it'll say, we need to meet with you in person on this date. It's usually not too far out in the future from when the letter is sent. And this meeting is required in order to continue your eligibility or to establish your eligibility. Well, our clients who do not have stable mailing addresses oftentimes will miss this notice, and they'll, as a result, be denied. And the agency has up to 30 days to make a decision on applications for food stamps. So a lot of times people apply, they don't hear anything, they think all is well, and 30 days goes by and they still haven't received any benefits or any notice. So I could imagine with a stricter work requirement and more punitive policies that would come out of, you know, HR 2, that people who are really trying to comply with all the program requirements just can't keep up. Either they miss a notice, or maybe they are working and they turn their timesheet in to show that they did the number of hours of work, but the worker on the other end doesn't properly enter that into the system. I mean, all these administrative barriers I could imagine playing out. The computer system that handles these you know, eligibility decisions, it's all automated right now. And so what you have is a system where it's programmed to deny a person benefits if not instructed otherwise within 30 days. And so you have to actually go into the computer program and tell it not to deny or not to terminate. Otherwise, that's absolutely what we'll do, what will happen, and an automated eligibility notice will just be sent by a computer system to a person saying you were denied or terminated for this reason. Please reapply.
So what you're saying is that the result of this will increase food insecurity and actually increase hunger in America. So rather than tackling the hunger problem face on and lowering those numbers, it's actually going to cause an increase. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned stereotypes and stigma before. And, you know, I think one of the stereotypes I've heard floated around is this idea that it's very easy to receive food stamps, and this could not be further from the truth. You know, I'm a lawyer, and my clients are all people who have been unlawfully denied or terminated from benefits. So my job is to help people access entitlements that, you know, just by virtue of being human and living in Maryland and having below a certain income level, you should be able to access. I do not think you should need a lawyer to access these benefits, but that's, you know, what my whole caseload is representing people who have been unlawfully denied in, you know, establishing eligibility for these programs.
So part of the preparation for this program I did was I actually went online to apply for food stamps as if I needed assistance. And I discovered how actually hard it was to do. And, I mean, it asked for a whole slew of paperwork that I couldn't even put my hands on. I wouldn't even know where it was. If I were housing insecure, I can see how that problem would be increased. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, there's because of, you know, the stereotypes floating around, I think our policies government policies have reacted to that, unfortunately, and that is how the program is structured in response to, you know, these fears about people receiving food stamps committing fraud or not using their benefits for, you know, the intended purpose or having several different food stamp cards that they have access to. And, you know, it's, like you said, incredibly difficult to access these benefits. And the way the system is structured is, you know, almost to assume that anyone applying is going to commit fraud. And so they make it so difficult to actually access. And instead of actually looking at what the reality is and the experiences of these families and responding and structuring the program to meet those needs, it's instead in response to, you know, all these fears out there. And so it's really, really difficult to access food stamps. And there are a lot of protections in place to prevent fraud. And there's constant, you know, quality control reviews. So, you know, those are, you know, some stigma that's just been reinforced in politics and by the media. But that's not actually the case. And unfortunately, you know, I've met hundreds of children and families and individuals who are, you know, starving and absolutely eligible for these benefits, and they have to wait so long just to get approved.
So in my research, I discovered that the estimates of fraud are between 1 and 1.5%, which seems to be one of the lowest amounts of fraud of any benefits program that I could find. Tina, in your opinion, this why has the SNAP program grown rather than declined in this country? And as somebody that has boots on the ground, how can you explain this so that we're so far out of the recession since 2008, and yet the people that are applying for this program are continuing to grow dramatically over the last 11 years?
Well, you just said it yourself, Gretchen. When you went to go and inquire about information, you went online, and there's your big difference. And you have to look at it as a different ratio. I think that the public in large looks at it as there's more people receiving food stamps. And what I would argue as someone, like you said, as boots on ground, is that there's more of an eligible population that was still previously eligible because it is an entitlement program based on your income, as Michelle said, you know, that are now able to apply online. And because you're able to apply remotely and you're able to receive your electronic benefit transfer card remotely, now people who previously wouldn't have money to come into an office to do an application now have access to be able to apply for the benefit program that they were always eligible for. So you truly have to look at the correct ratio of that, not necessarily more Americans on the food stamp program, but more Americans who were eligible for food stamps in the first place who now have access to it remotely.
That's a very excellent point. So you're saying that the transportation piece is eliminated from that, so that people in rural areas who before couldn't even get to an office now can apply online. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. So, Michelle, there's currently an anti-fraud SNAP anti-fraud campaign in D.C. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's lots of billboards, big, glaring red signs in grocery stores talking about SNAP fraud. And as we just discussed, SNAP fraud is extremely low. Could you explain why there's this perception that the program takes money from hardworking Americans and gives it to the undeserving poor?
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, I think this, you know, the food stamp program, you know, has a lot of racism attached to it. Like when we talk about the undeserving, when we talk about welfare or food stamp recipients, those have now become code words for race. And so, you know, when most Americans think of someone who's living in poverty, a couple things come to mind. It's, you know, someone who's black and someone who is less committed to work than other Americans or who would prefer to live off of the government instead of work. You know, this is an image, like I said before, that, you know, our politicians and the media has continued to reproduce. And so that, I think, is why this is the image that comes to most Americans' minds when they think of these programs. But, it, you know, these, we have to be careful. These stereotypes, you know, have very racist roots. Like the idea that blacks are lazy is a stereotype that came about during slavery. It was used to defend slavery. And we see this stereotype continue to creep up and guide policies today, like the work requirement. And, you know, the idea that, you know, you have to work in order to receive food. You have to do something and prove that you're actively doing something in order to eat. You know, the misconceptions about poverty and food stamp recipients have completely been shaped by the media's coverage of poverty, which has, you know, often been racially biased and focusing on images of people living in poverty, you know, and less sympathetic stories, and really just shaping this narrative on, you know, who receives food stamps has resulted in this, you know, unconscious influence on people's attitudes towards food stamp recipients, when in fact, I was looking up before the show, 30% of total SNAP benefits in 2016 went to African-American households. So the majority of, you know, food stamp recipients are not actually African-American, but there's this, you know, deep racist history with these entitlement programs in this country, which has shaped the way that we view them. If you look at, you know, almost any other country in the world, there are other public benefit or government benefit programs that operate to make sure that, you know, people have a safe place to live at night or, you know, access to the minimum amount of food to stay alive or water or whatever other basic essential commodity. You know, other governments around the country have, around the world, have various programs, and there isn't this stigma attached that we have here in the U.S. The U.S. is one of the only countries in the world that has not acknowledged access to food is a human right. 30 other countries have an explicit recognition of the right to adequate food in their national constitutions, and a whole host of other countries recognize it in other ways through national policies or programs or laws. You know, the U.S. certainly produces enough food to feed everyone and prevent anyone from going hungry, but unfortunately so much food is wasted, and we don't embrace this idea of access to food as a human right.
So, Michelle, you're saying basically in a country that produces over 100 billion pounds of food waste every year, we don't recognize food as a basic human right to live.
Correct.
Kristen, I wanted to get back to you about stigmatism, but we are running out of time. So we are going to have to continue this conversation next time on June 15th. What I'd like everyone to do that has been listening in is to email me with your questions. You can go to my website. It's chefgretchenhansen.com. Hansen is spelled with an O, and you will see a link there that says email me. We've had a lot of questions popping up just while we've been on the air of people that have had experiences with food stamps and are afraid to share them. And I'd like to take the just a few seconds to thank my panel. I'm going to be back here with you all on June 15th at 9 a.m. But I also want to close with Kristen telling me about a little bit about the stigmatism you experienced on food stamps while you were accepting benefits for your family.
Well, I try not to pay attention to any of that, but it is hard, you know, and you get in line and you pull your card out and has the little blue hen on it for Delaware. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get the long, hairy eyeball. I'm like, oh,
right.
You know, look at her with her nice purse. Well, I got it at the thrift store. You know right. what I mean? Or judging what I have in my cart.
Right. And so you chose to feed your family over dealing with that stigmatism. Is that a choice you regret?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Well, I'd like to thank my panel today. This has been a quite enlightening conversation and just the beginning of the conversation we are going to have about this. The vote comes on June 22nd for HR 2, which is the Farm Bill. This is Delmarva Today, and I'm Gretchen Hansen sitting in for Don Rush. Thanks for taking the time to listen in, and I'd like to thank my panel, Tina Maria Lopez and Michelle Medio and Kristen Homan.
Thank you.
The battle for the 1st Congressional District is witness to four Democrats vying for their party's nomination. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. One of those candidates is Alison Galbraith. She was raised in Bel Air and has been a small business owner specializing in federal contracting and acquisition streamlining. She's made health care, education, along with economic development some of her top priorities. But she and three other Democrats in the race are trying to unseat Republican incumbent Andy Harris in a very conservative district. Indeed, is even more so since the last redistricting. And she joins us this morning in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, as I mentioned, this is a very conservative district. How do you appeal to those people who see themselves as conservative, and certainly in the western, the eastern shore here? A lot of Donald Trump signs, still a lot of Trump supporters, a lot of Republicans. What's the appeal here? How do you tell them, I'm a Democrat and I'm for you?
It's not so much about being a Democrat. It's about being one of the everyday people and understanding what the issues that they're facing are. Their problems are my problems. And one of the things that I focus on a lot is anti-corruption and getting big money out of politics, because I don't think you'll find anybody on either side of the aisle that thinks it's a good idea that their representative is spending more time talking to donors than they are talking to the everyday people who really need their help. Their job is to be a public servant. And that resonates, the idea that I'm actually middle class. I don't have the luxury of quitting my job to run. And I stood up for a totally different reason, I think, than most candidates, in that I actually went to go see Andy Harris and I asked him for help. And he made it pretty clear that if his policies passed, then he was going to put me out of business for no other reason than I was a woman and had a complicated pregnancy. No woman wants to hear that. It doesn't matter what party you are. And I talk to everybody, and just keeping an open mind and hearing both sides of an issue and being able to maintain some semblance of objectivity and say, hey, you know what? Democrats do things wrong sometimes, too. That goes a long way.
Do you consider yourself a progressive?
Yeah, I do. I don't think that I fit cleanly into some political box. My bachelor's degree was in philosophy with a focus in logic and ethics. And then my grad school work was in public policy. So if you want to know where I fall on an issue, all you need to look at is where critical thinking and ethics and good public policy are going to put you. It's not a partisan ideology issue. It's what works best for the people and what helps people the most and what can make the most difference in the lives of everyday people. I'm really about the everyday people. I guess if you had to lump me in somewhere, you'd say I'm a populist. I just want what's right for people and what helps them.
Let me ask you this, and before we get off this. Where do you see yourself in terms of, say, the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party as opposed to, say, something or maybe like the Clinton portion of the party? Where do you see yourself falling?
It is a tough question because I think if we're still talking about the Bernie Hillary mess, then your feet aren't close enough to the fire that you could. I mean, like I said, I could actually lose my business over some of these GOP policies. So I'm very much about taking back Congress and kind of leave it at that. But I guess which wing? I don't know. I bridge them. I have people from across the entire political spectrum. I have Hillary supporters. I have Bernie supporters. I have Green Party people who flip back to Democrat to come support me. And I actually have a tremendous number of Republicans and Libertarians and Independents who have gone and switched their political affiliation to come help me in the primary. And like I said, it's just been a matter of showing up and listening to people and I think part of it is understanding that a representative's job is not necessarily to have all the answers or to vote in the way that they want. It's to represent. It's to listen. It's to advocate. It's to go into Congress and say, this is what the people of my district need.
Now, speaking of Washington, if you were elected to the House of Representatives, one of the possible jobs you might have is a vote on impeachment. We've seen, of course, lots of scandals unfolding out of the Trump administration. We've had just recently financial disclosures. If you were sitting in the House of Representatives, would you vote to impeach?
If evidence is there that suggests that that's what ought to be done, absolutely. May justice prevail. And I would say the same exact thing on the opposite side of the aisle. If it were a member of my own party, I would say the same thing. If you're not abiding by the law and you're not doing what your job is, then you can go. We don't need you.
Well, given what you're seeing so far coming out of news reports where the Mueller investigation is going, do you see that as a possibility?
It does certainly appear to be headed in that direction, yes.
Mm-hmm. And does that give you concern?
Pence concerns me.
In what sense?
Pence concerns me in some ways more than Trump because I think he could accomplish an awful lot quietly without anybody really noticing what he's doing. I think in some ways you need to watch him even more because this agenda that they're pushing isn't good for people. It's geared towards corporations and just the ideology and the policies behind it are of real concern to everyday people.
I want to turn to healthcare. What kind of solutions do you favor for healthcare? Do you support the Affordable Care Act? Would you support, say, the single payer system? What's your sense about that?
So there's HR 676, which is the Medicare for All bill in the House, and I would happily co-sponsor that because I think that universal healthcare is what we need to be moving towards for sure. That said, I'm a business owner today because of the Affordable Care Act. Before the Affordable Care Act, I couldn't buy health insurance as a woman. Women were charged 30 to 80% more for the same policies. They didn't even include maternity. So we're not talking about any cost difference there. Women were just being price gouged. And then I'd had a C-section and postpartum depression, and those things were considered pre-existing conditions. So at 26 years old, I couldn't buy a policy. My options were go back to work full time after having my son or to go into the high risk pool, which if you adjust for inflation would cost me $600 a month today. So totally unaffordable for a young family. And I opted to go back to work full time where I could actually buy a reasonably priced policy. I think it is important to understand that ACA, while it's benefited many, is not good for everybody. It's been troublesome for people who are otherwise healthy, but maybe between the ages of 45 and 64 before you're eligible for Medicare. It's rocked the employer provided policies in a way that I think was unexpected, in that you now need to pay individually per child and an addition for your spouse instead of just having one family plan that was $400. And unless you ever hit a lifetime cap or had a chronic problem or a pre-existing condition and a long employment gap, most people probably didn't run into that. So they're understandably aggravated about ACA and the impacts. It is also important to understand that ACA brought costs down in a lot of ways, that premiums were going up regardless. And I think it's a temporary solution. I do not think ACA is a long-term solution. I think that universal health care, and there are a couple of different ways you can get to it, whether it be Medicare for all, some other single-payer system. There's even a really interesting catastrophic hybrid universal policy floating around. Any of those would probably be better than what we're dealing with right now, and more affordable, and lead to better health outcomes and better quality care. But also, it's important to remember that if you take the burden off of the employers to provide that benefit, then it gives people tremendous job flexibility. I was able to start and keep a business because I was finally able to buy a policy on the private market for the first time in my life. Imagine if all these people who stay in the workforce longer than they want to simply because they can't purchase a policy or they can't afford a private policy and they're not eligible for Medicare yet. Imagine if they dropped down to part-time, had better quality of life, went and did what they wanted to do, whether it be, I don't know, antiquing or boating or spending time with their grandkids. They could do that. And then these young people who are just itching to move up in their careers would have additional advancement opportunities available to them. People who want to start businesses can go out on their own and start their own businesses. It opens up a world of opportunity, and it's better for small business, and it's cheaper for everybody. You just have to be careful about how you implement the policy so that you don't end up with, I think the general concern is that you ended up with a bloated, redundant, inefficient system, right? That's an implementation problem. That is not a question of the policy and where it belongs, and does it make sense for everybody to have some standard of health care given to them.
By the way, along those lines, how do you get from here to there? That is, we have this current system, a private market insurance system. How do you get from that to, say, a single payer system, given the fact that you have this entire financial infrastructure that's all in place, the insurance companies, the way they do business, and so on and so forth, and employs a lot of people and so on? How do you get from there, from here to there, as it were? You have any sense about that at this point?
Well, you'd have to at the same time have transition programs to help people whose jobs were lost because of it. I mean, yes, it's going to be a big, big difference, and you need to go in and maybe it even makes more sense to look at local areas and figure out what do you need in a particular area to stabilize that. Where are we heavy in the health insurance industry, and what do we need to go and do to make sure that those people don't just end up unemployed? That's the last thing that you want, is to leave anybody unemployed. But there would be jobs with the new system too. So you would just retrain and you push them over into that, and you would probably want to give some precedence or preference to people who are already working in that industry and found themselves displaced. That's part of it. I think the bigger concern is the lobbying power of the health insurance industry and the medical industry, and how much money they put into continuing their existence, really. But I would also say that any industry where their profit motive is completely misaligned with the well-being of the people is not something that's working for us as a society.
I want to turn to a trade. Where were you on the Trans-Pacific Partnership agreement? As we know, the president pulled out of that. What's your sense about trade and the issue about jobs going overseas?
I think we need to incentivize companies to keep their jobs here. And I think that we need to renegotiate some of these agreements to ensure that fair labor standards are in place, that we have environmental protections in place, and that we're not just sending money and jobs overseas for cheaper goods when the trade-off is actually a significant harm to our environment, or that other people in other countries are losing their worker protections. I mean, there are ways where you can have a happy medium where everybody ends up sort of better off. And yeah, it's, I mean, it's hard to get towards that. It's diplomacy. It's good negotiating. But working towards better quality of life for the workers, I think, is the way that you want to go when you're renegotiating these things. TPP specifically, it had flaws. You know, no policy is without flaws. You would definitely have wanted to see some changes if we had proceeded with that. But like I said, renegotiating so that it's more beneficial to the workers and making sure that we have environmental protections and strengthened workers' rights.
What about the issue of tariffs? The president has made that as or talked about as that as a weapon in order to force some of these countries, such as China, to come across and be fair.
I think carefully used, right? Like, I would want to see the analysis on the impacts of any of these decisions. I've had some interesting conversations about the steel tariffs in particular, and it was with United Steelworkers, and they actually said, you know, this is okay, because the steel that was coming in from China was dirtier anyway, and we need these American jobs. And I think that it just turns into a sort of gray area, and we need to be careful and look at what the impacts of each particular thing is and what it's going to be on our economy and make a decision on a case-by-case basis.
Turning to education, there have been some suggestions that college should be free or that community college should be free. I know there's some talk at the local level about providing a free tuition-free mm-hmm. college, for instance, at the local level. What do you think is the solution to the cost of higher education, and particularly the kind of student debt that gets racked up?
Oh, so much needs to be done about student debt. It's I think a lot of people think that younger people, the millennials, the younger millennials in particular, are just lazy. No, they're having to get more and more degrees to get the same jobs, and then they're graduating with a mortgage worth of student loan debt and having trouble finding jobs even when they get out. And then they can't do what they like. They get roped into something that's just going to pay their debt and while living in their parents' house, and people point fingers and call them lazy. It's unfortunate. I think the community colleges and trade schools would be pretty easy to make free. They're not terribly expensive. There's already a tremendous amount of Pell Grants, which go unused every year. Actually, my parents were both professors. My dad taught at Hartford Community College for 45 years, and my mom started programs at both University of Baltimore and Morgan State. So the community colleges are cheap. You can do that pretty easily, I think. And I think that the return on investment is going to be significant. And those are easy enough. My concern when you start talking about the four-year universities is that there may be some difference in quality if you try to move towards completely free. So maybe a solution is to have one free university in each state, or a couple of them in each state, so that they do have forced competition and the other universities in the area have to drive down their costs if they want to keep up their student recruitment. But I think that one of the underlying issues that you don't hear a whole lot about is the fact that you can't bankrupt out of student loans. So they follow you around forever. Now, with a mortgage, right, or a car, a bank's not going to loan you more than they think that it's worth, because they go and they take that asset. You know, but the student loans you can't bankruptcy out of, which has led to a very predatory industry. And there's no disincentive whatsoever for them to stop giving these loans. And then there's no disincentive for the colleges to rein in their costs, because the kids are getting the loans for whatever it is that they need. I think that if you change that loophole and you were to allow bankruptcy out in particular situations, or more situations than we currently do, that the market itself would probably check itself pretty quickly. Now, I would want to see analysis on what the actual impact of doing that is, because I'm sure there are things I've not considered. But that seems to me, the fact that there's no disincentive from predatory lending to be at the root of a lot of it. And eventually they'd have to check their prices. They'd have to reduce them and they'd have to find a way to compete. We have to do something about student debt also, and the fact that people are drowning in it, people who've already graduated, and find, you know, maybe public service programs all over the country, something more like AmeriCorps, something that can be done in your own local community if you can't move out of your community. You know, something looks maybe like the GI Bill or student debt relief or forgiveness for public servant jobs. Look at, you know, social workers have to have a master's degree to practice, but then they make almost nothing. So how are you supposed to pay for that kind of thing when you get out and you just end up in a very poor situation, which snowballs for your whole life and has a impact not just on our generation, but future ones also? There have to be things that we can do to get out of it. I think a lot of it is in the lending end and talking to the universities and going line by line through their budgets and figuring out, what are you spending money on? Why is this like this? Why do you need to charge so much? Is it that you built this new gym? Is that new gym bringing in all of this money? And setting up some alternative programs. Online programs are cheap. You know, things like that. There are a lot of different ways, I think, that you could tackle it, but it's about providing options and getting rid of some of the predatory behavior.
Turning to the environment, how do you balance the interests of agriculture, farming on the one hand, and the environment on the other, especially when it comes to the Chesapeake Bay and trying to deal with the pollution that obviously has been a problem over the years? A number of people in the farming community say, hey, we've done our part, and we're not really the problem. It's the cities above. Yeah, how do you balance those two?
With Maryland farmers, I think have largely done their part. They're pretty responsible, and one of the more interesting conversations that I had was at this farm. It was at a farm fair, mm-hmm. And I walked up to this woman, and I was just kind of asking her questions, and she immediately started yelling at me about Nancy Pelosi and Obama. So you could tell which side of the political spectrum she was on. And I asked her about environmental protections and farming, responsible farming. And she said, we don't overspray. We don't overspray. It costs too much to do it. And then she said, and we don't just let our cows wander off into the water. That's irresponsible. You can't go and do that. They're already doing their part. And I said, well, I understand that a lot of the runoff in the bay is coming from New York, Pennsylvania, farms up there, industry up there. And she said, yeah, well, it's not, you know, we're doing what we can do towards this. And Maryland's better about it than a lot of states are. And I said, well, would you support federal regulations saying that farmers in other areas needed to be implementing these same responsible techniques that you all have? And she goes, absolutely, which is the last thing you would expect from somebody who, I think one of the other things she said in the same breath as the Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama comment was, no more regulations. But she was in full support of other states going and doing it because she understood that it was sustainable for the family farms, that they could do that. Not only could they do that, they knew that it was necessary to go and do that. So I think it's a matter of some federal legislation where these are your standards, you know, and stop letting these rollbacks happen of, you know, Clean Air, Clean Water Act and letting pesticides get into our waterways. I mean, that's a real, real concern.
Now, one of the big issues, of course, is obviously clean energy and particularly offshore wind. As you're probably aware of, there are proposals for some offshore wind farms off Ocean City. City officials don't like the idea of them being as close as they've been proposed. The people who have the farms or proposing the farms say, well, but they need them that close. If they push them out too far, then they can't really be effective. Where are you in terms particularly about the Ocean City situation with these wind farms?
I support the wind farms, and that was made at the that decision was made at the state level.
Right.
It wasn't like there was no talk about it or nobody knew what was going on with it. There was a significant amount of time and energy and discussion and proposals and planning that went into doing that. Maryland's already got money wrapped up into it. And my understanding is that if you went and pushed them back to 24, I think it was 24, 26 miles offshore that Harris tried to push for in that federal amendment, that the technology that's there right now just wouldn't work. So the projects, it's essentially shutting down the projects, if you're saying that. But I will add, I've done research, I've done my due diligence in response to these concerns that it has an impact on tourism, and have found nothing supporting the idea that areas which have wind farms have had a negative impact to tourism or to local industry or any major issues whatsoever, or any kind of economic hit. So the idea that that is going to happen is, frankly, not substantiated.
I want to turn to foreign policy, and of course, probably the biggest, one of the biggest events that has occurred has been the president's decision to pull out of the Iran deal, the nuclear Iran deal. What's your opinion on that? Should we have stayed in? What's your sense about that?
Yeah, I think we should have stayed in. It was obviously not a perfect deal, but I think it was probably the best option of several bad options. And I'm concerned that we might end up in a war over it if we're not careful what we're doing there. And I think we need to be careful not to destabilize regions and go getting ourselves into unnecessary conflicts.
How much involvement do you think the U.S. should have in the Middle East, particularly militarily? I mean, we have some troops still in Iraq. We certainly have troops in Afghanistan. You're going to have to sit there and vote for the appropriation for these forces.
It's a tough one. It depends on the region. It depends on why we're there and what our mission is there. I really think it just depends on why, and that those decisions need to be made on a case-by-case basis. That said, I mean, I work in this with Department of Defense. I consult for Department of Defense part-time, and I'm familiar enough with what is going on there that I would be extremely concerned to hear anybody say they wanted to escalate anything in those regions. Now, when you pull out, you can't just leave a vacuum, or you give way to rise of things like ISIS. So it's just a matter of being careful, making informed decisions, looking at the intelligence that's available, and you know, letting the military come in and make these recommendations, and the State Department come in and make these recommendations, actually listening to the experts instead of, so much just comes down to political ideology now and what's going to make your base happy. That's not why we should be making decisions, especially when it comes to foreign policy. I was also married to a combat veteran for over a decade, so you know, I explained to a toddler every night for a year, Daddy's coming home. Daddy's coming home. I'm not sending anybody out into harm's way unless there is a really, really, really good reason to go and do that.
Do you think it's a good reason, say, in Afghanistan?
In Afghanistan? Now, I think we need to, there still probably needs to be some level of stabilization effort there, but I don't think that we need to be in any sort of full-blown conflict there. I mean, that the intent of that years ago was to train their forces so that they could take it over and then withdraw. But if you've ever seen Charlie Wilson's War, you know that you can't drop what you started.
What do you make, by the way, of the situation with North Korea? We've had some on and off things. It looks as if there probably will be a summit, although there seems to be some rumblings of perhaps not. Think the president is taking the right approach in terms of meeting with, possibly meeting with Kim Jong-un?
Frankly, I was surprised that happened. And if that's a result of, egging them on or whatever he was doing. Okay, so I'm taking a wait-and-see approach on North Korea. But I will say that we do not want to get into a conflict with North Korea, nor do North Korea's neighbors want us to go and get into a conflict with North Korea.
Right. So in terms of the atmosphere that we now live in, we have lots of charges about fake news. There are people who distrust mainstream media or trust one outlet as opposed to another. Just recently, I think, was the former now Secretary of State, tell us who said to be wobbly in the truth is to be wobbly in America. We really get some – what kind of era do you think we're living in where people – They're not even operating from the same what they at least believe to be facts.
Well, I don't know. That's a really complicated question. It's unfortunate that that's what it's come to. And I would say double check, triple check your sources and make sure you're looking at a news source that is either known to be objective and that you're probably cross-checking it with sources on the left and the right before you go and repeat anything. I don't know that we can realistically expect people to actually do that. But maybe I guess I would say think twice about anything you hear and wonder, is it really true? And it just makes me sad that that's what we've come to. That's the advice that you have to give and say, okay, how has this been biased? How has this been slanted? What's being fed to us? What's the agenda? Why? Why? But I think it also demonstrates that we're distrustful of media. We're distrustful of our own government telling us the truth. I don't even know what to make of it, but I hope that we can take government back and have it actually working for the people again and have it be honest and have people trust it and trust our news sources. And maybe it goes to show that what we really need to be doing is something about things like Russia meddling in our elections, because we know that not all of it's coming from here.
What do you think that does to our politics?
I think it's dangerous. I think it's divisive. It's confusing to people. A lot of people are just throwing up their hands and going, well, I don't know what to believe anymore.
I mean, when you run across, because you meet people all the time. Many of them are obviously Republican, the conservatives, certainly. Are they looking at the world in a dramatically different fashion and say somebody who might be a liberal or on the Democratic side? I mean, is there that great divide where they just they're not talking to one another?
They want the same things. And people on both sides of the aisle are very quick to jump down the throat of somebody who expresses an imposing point of view. I've been great at flipping Republicans and libertarians, as I said, and I think it's because I look for something to agree with them on, and I try and understand what their points are. A recent case that comes to mind is somebody saying to me something about prosecuting Hillary or something like that. They've had more investigations into that. If they were going to find anything, they would have. But what I said to him is, may justice prevail. And if people are guilty, then they should be held responsible. If they're not, they should not be. And universal truths. Look for universal truths that you can agree with people on and get along with them that way. Instead of nitpicking and fighting over the details, unless it's a matter of – the one thing I will get into is what is the actual impact of a policy if you approach it one way versus another way. I'll get into those discussions, and I tend to tie it with personal stories of, well, you know, here's this situation in my life or somebody I know's life, and this is what happened to them because of this thing. And that, I find, is another way, a personal story, a personal connection, the heartstrings approach to opening minds a little bit and just having a conversation. But generally speaking, if you're civil to people, they'll be civil back to you.
We were speaking with Alison Gulber. She is one of the Democratic candidates vying to unseat Congressman Andy Harris in the 1st Congressional District. I appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you very much.
We're referring, of course, to former Secretary Tillerson there and his quote about America and the truth. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.